KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland. I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
Coming up, we'll hear how solar energy is empowering people in a Berkeley homeless encampment.
We just quintupled our power output. Now we'll be able to charge wheelchairs, we'll be able to run kitchen appliances, we're able to run the refrigerator.
Then we'll meet a local artist who's documenting a peculiar trend in San Francisco house paint.
All these events that are loud and violent and really affecting the neighborhood, suddenly there's these great houses.
And we'll hear the memories of the oldest park ranger in the country, stationed right here in the Bay Area.
I was the only one in the room who could look at the scattered sites and see them all as sites of segregation.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. For a few generations now, Berkeley has been home to alternative living arrangements like communes and co-ops. There's a new intentional community keeping this tradition alive. Here, no one's in charge, and decisions are made by consensus. This place is at the forefront of the housing crisis. In fact, it's the reason the people here came together in the first place. KALW's Alice Wolfley has more.
It's a beautiful sunny day in South Berkeley, and Robin Silver is working on solar panels.
I'm sort of trying to thwart any thieves and slow them down if they wish to steal this.
This solar system is a work in progress. It took a while to cobble together all the different components.
We've just quintupled our power output here. We can, previously we've only been able to charge cell phones, laptops. Now we'll be able to charge wheelchairs, we'll be able to run kitchen appliances, we're able to run the refrigerator.
While he works, he tells me about the diversity of his community.
I think this camp is kind of a microcosm of the world's social ills. You know, we're sort of the world in a teapot here. You know, there are people who've been millionaires here, people with PhDs, people who've never read a book. You know, it's been magical, it's been traumatic, it's been stressful.
And that creates challenges.
So, you know, there's two different realities going on here. One is the ideal that we're consensus, and the reality is, you know, who's got the most moxie and will to get their way.
In spite of their diversity, they all face one common challenge: homelessness. Because of the housing crisis, homeless encampments are an increasingly common sight all over the Bay Area. This camp sits between the sidewalk and the curb on a busy stretch of Adeline Avenue. Every few minutes, passing BART trains interrupt conversation. It's like BART has a pause button on their lives.
I like this living situation here. It works for me.
Leslie Deegan tells me it's a sober camp. They have a locked porta potty and weekly trash pickup. The camp has been in this spot for over a year. Leslie's worried they'll be asked to move.
I've been wondering why we haven't been served with an eviction notice. And I've been thinking about it every day.
So why hasn't the city moved them?
Our strategy towards homeless encampments is we prioritize based on health and safety concerns.
Mathai Chaco is the assistant to Berkeley's city manager.
Over the past year, I believe there were 20 times that we moved an encampment. The kinds of complaints that we've seen in different parts of the city have included things from garbage or feces or needles or criminal behavior.
There are over 1,000 homeless people in Berkeley alone, up 13% in the last 2 years.
We spend about $17 million per year on services for around homelessness. We, over the past few years, have tried to transition more and more of our funding and our focus to getting people housed.
The money also goes towards mental health workers, a mobile crisis unit, and an outreach team that offers services to people on the street.
And yet, it's still not enough.
He says when camps are moved, everyone is offered a voucher for a shelter, but many prefer to stay on the streets. If Leslie has to move, he says he won't take a shelter voucher either.
I tried the shelters, and I was attacked twice in the shelters. That's how I lost quite a bit of my upper teeth.
But he has benefited from other services the city offers.
I'm getting good medical treatment out here. there's a clinic not too far from here that is throws out the net and helps catch people like me, and I landed there and immediately started to respond to medication, and I'm doing much better these days.
He says his life is more stable than it's been in years, which is why he hopes their camp doesn't have to move.
The thought of returning back to the sidewalk, it's just, I don't want to do that.
Robin Silver thinks the solar panels will help shield them from removal.
I think there are one of our biggest positive public relations visual symbols. I think they show organization, ingenuity. Along with the solar panels, just the orderly arrangement of the tents and keeping the camp clean.
I ask what might happen to the solar panels if the camp did have to move.
In some ways, I view them as a sand painting, you know, at least when I'm in my better moments, is done that, hey, this can all be wiped away in a second, so don't be attached, you know. And that's a big lesson for life, because realizing the impermanence of all things and being okay with that.
If they do have to move, Robin says they'll move as a community and continue to look out for each other.
The human beings are human beings, regardless of economic and living situation. You know, treat everybody as, you know, sentient beings and, you know, see the light in everybody.
He says if they can live together and solve their problems harmoniously, the rest of the world can too. In Berkeley, I'm Alice Wolfley for Cross Currents.
Alice is a reporter in our summer journalism training program. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. When artist Sergio De La Torre first moved to San Francisco in the early 1990s, he was struck by the variety of colors that dressed the city's homes. In his neighborhood, the Mission District, houses were painted with every color of the spectrum. Today, though, one color seems to be taking over the rest, gray. For the past several months, Sergio has photographed at least 175 of these freshly painted gray homes. But why gray? And why now? KALW's Sophie Codner has the story.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
So we're going to go to the left.
I'm on a walk with Sergio around his neighborhood. There's something he wants to show me.
This is the one.
He points to a house down the street. I spy it over a line of ficus trees that shade the city block.
So I woke up one morning and that house was painted gray. And you can see it from here. That was the first gray house that I saw.
The house he points out looks like a typical old San Francisco Victorian. Well, in its shape at least. It reminds me of the famous Painted Ladies, which are these extravagantly detailed, colorful houses. But this house isn't colorful.
And I saw they got the scaffoldings, you know, I saw the painting every single day. And I was like, what was happening?
Sergio tells me that this house used to be a recovery house for people with mental illness. Its residents would walk around the neighborhood.
And you could see them. I mean, they were mentally unstable. So they were wearing pajamas, you know, their hairs were all messed up, you know, smoking cigarettes, touching their heads, you know, making these random movements. And they were part of the neighborhood.
Sergio grew up around all kinds of people in his family's neighborhood in Tijuana, Mexico.
You see people that were not necessarily, you know, quote-unquote normal. But they're part of who you are in this neighborhood.
Now, the recovery house has been split into multiple units, and each flat goes for more than $4,000. Sergio sees only one of the prior residents still hanging around the Mission.
Walking around the neighborhood, I notice, you know, more gray houses.
Within just a couple of blocks, we see several.
We can cross.
There's a dark gray house.
It's like a charcoal house.
There's a big gray house.
This is another gray building. The entire building is gray. It's a two-story.
Almost all of them have a few key features. Dark to light gray paint, house numbers made out of metal,
That's another one. Another gray house with sans serif numbers.
Often you find a colorful accent.
And a yellow door.
I prepare for these gray houses to follow me home. It's one of those things where once you notice it, you see it everywhere.
Oh my God, another one.
The paint looks fresh. Many still have a for sale sign in the front yard. But as I leave Sergio, I wonder, how new is this gray, really?
Let's just go back to the choice of color, and let's look at it historically.
Tanu Sankalia is the program director of urban studies at the University of San Francisco. I sit with him at his home office in Berkeley.
So 1850 to, let's say, 1905, you get this great period of construction.
With the invention of new tools, wood could be bent and curved and shaped as desired for the first time. That's why we get the detailed ornamental style Victorians are known for. And significantly for this story, wood begs for paint, more than other building materials.
We have a number of somewhere close to 50,000 houses being built during this period.
And they're painted with subdued, earthy colors, including gray. By the 1940s, the Second World War, the Bay Area emerges as a hub for building ships for the Navy, which leaves behind a surplus of paint, battleship gray paint.
And a lot of people got their hands on it and painted their houses gray. There was a kind of a desire to be austere during the austerity measures during the World War. There was probably a desire to stay somewhat unnoticed.
2 decades later, the tone of the country changed.
People who emerged in the 60s, you know, with the hippie era and the sort of freedom and self-expression and so on, and they take on these houses and start doing something with them.
It's called the colorist movement. The paint on Victorians during this time made them feel funky and resplendent. Now, that's how a lot of people think San Francisco houses should feel.
We also think of color as perhaps a representative of certain ethnic groups.
Think of the colorful buildings of Mexico. I asked Tanu about the gray houses that artist Sergio de la Torre has been photographing in the Mission, a neighborhood that for the last few decades has been made up of largely low to middle income Latin Americans.
It instantly becomes a signifier for something, and we want it to be a signifier for something. So there's a tendency to reduce that signifier very quickly to the idea of gentrification.
That's because so many people moving in are younger and wealthier and may like their houses as gray as their MacBook computers.
I wouldn't mind buying that one. That's the problem with being in this business. 2.9, 2.3, that's good.
Carol Koffel and I are huddled over her laptop in an office of her real estate company, Vanguard. Carol is a real estate agent and a color consultant.
Okay, well, here's one.
We scan open house listings and Pinterest, seeing the gray trend way beyond San Francisco.
Gray Victorians in London. They've been doing this for years.
Same thing in Toronto. You can see the gray on Washington, D.C. row houses, and in Trondheim, Norway, where the gray trend has spread like an oil spill since the early 2000s.
We live in a world that's so full of information. And when you look at a Victorian home that's fully painted, it's a little busy for our eye.
With gray paint, she says, you let the architecture speak for itself. You draw the eye upward with lighter values to give the illusion of increased height. And done correctly,
your own home is standing out because it is different, but in a quiet way.
But what about when there are multiple houses on the same block that are all painted gray?
If the house next door is painted gray and your house is gray and the one next door to that is gray, it won't work.
Just like fashion goes from the runway to the department store, the gray trend has spread from architects to house flippers. At the start of the trend in 2014, a real estate site, Curbed SF, mapped the city's most money-making housing flips. More than one-third of the houses they listed had a gray exterior. And while Carol still believes that gray paint can quiet the mind, as the trend multiplies, artist Sergio de la Torre can't help but see the opposite.
You know, yellow house, blue house, green house, gray house. So they're very loud.
Gray can be considered a mute color, a non-color even. But to Sergio, these gray houses are loud. As loud as the changes happening in his city. Like the evictions, police brutality, fires, and the threat from immigration and customs enforcement, ICE.
All these events, you know, that are loud and violent and really affecting the neighborhood, suddenly there's these gray houses, you know, they're kind of this mute color. And I questioned that, you know, it's like, why a mute color now? You know, it's like, if anything, you cannot be mute. You know, you cannot be non-color. You cannot be simple right now.
But Sergio knows that equating gray with gentrification is oversimplifying things too. He's looked into the backstory of 60 of the houses he's photographed. Only 4 were evictions. Actually, Sergio's neighbor's house was hidden behind scaffolding when we walked by. Do I even have to tell you what color he's painting it?
And I was like, why gray? Because it's a simple color. How is it simple? I don't know, it's just like modern and elegant. And, you know, it's like, I'm tired of these painted ladies. You know, it's like, I don't want color like this house next door. You know, it's like, I just want a flat house.
Houses are typically repainted every 7 or so years. And although gray has a long history here, the next trend in house paint has already arrived. All white. Fair to say, I don't think Sergio will be happy about this color either. In San Francisco, I'm Sophie Codner for Cross Currents.
Sophie is a reporter in our summer journalism training program. Find more info at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. We'll head up to the city of Richmond for our next piece. If you've ever visited the museum at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park on the waterfront there, chances are you've heard of its most celebrated storyteller. Betty Reed Soskin is the country's oldest park ranger. She's 97 years old. Her talks pack the house, of course, and she's helped shape the scope of the museum through her personal recollections. Now, there's a new 50-minute documentary film about Betty that will screen at the historical park. Today, from our StoryCorps archives, we bring you part of her story in her own words.
Rosie the Riveter as a concept leaves out an awful lot of history. As a woman of color, during that period, I never did see a ship under construction. I came in to work every day in a carpool, working in the center of Richmond in a temporary building that was the segregated union hall, because the unions were not yet racially integrated. So all of the black workers were funneled into this temporary union where we had no power, no vote, paid union dues, but were segregated. But you have to go back 3 years before then. I would have been Betty Charbonnet graduating from high school in Oakland. I would have been the child of a service workers' generation. Our fathers and our uncles were the Pullman porters and the waiters and the red caps, the bellhops, the janitors. Our mothers were 50 cents an hour domestic servants who took care of white people's homes and white people's children. And when I graduated from high school, my full expectation was to take my place in that world. And if you now scroll ahead to 13 years ago, and I'm back in Richmond as an equal participant in the planning of a park, I was the only one in the room who could look at the scattered sites and see them all as sites of segregation, because I'm the only person of color in the room. I became of value as a primary source. And I'm doing that not having become a genius between the time I was 20 and 13 years ago, but as a result of how much social change had occurred in this nation over those intervening years. And much of that acceleration came about because of what happened here in Richmond. Henry Kaiser, who believed that he could revolutionize shipbuilding, that all he had to do was to de-skill labor and break it into bite-sized pieces that even women could do or even black people could do. And he brought into a city of 23,000 a workforce of 98,000 black and white Southerners into Richmond to build his ships without the benefit of focus groups and diversity training, and that they had to negotiate every day to get through it, and that that negotiation could happen, accelerated the rate of change that sowed the seeds of the Civil Rights Revolution in the 60s. What I haven't said is that my great-grandmother was born into slavery in 1846, that she was enslaved until she was 19. She was freed with the Emancipation Proclamation. But my great-grandmother lived to be 102. My mother, who was born in 1894, lived to be 101. But the three of us were all adult women together. And that all of that American history, slavery through Reconstruction and Plessy v. Ferguson and the First World War and Lindbergh's flight.
Lindbergh! Lindbergh is coming down as a gang fence.
There's the boy. Amelia Earhart.
Then to a waiting world came news of disaster.
And Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
That one day on the red hills of Georgia.
Selma and Birmingham.
We are going to walk non-violently and peacefully.
And the moon landing and the Mars probe.
Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
The assassination of the Kennedys.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
All of that happened within the lifetime of three American women of color. That's not black history. That is what we've all done.
That's Betty Reed Soskin, who told her story to StoryCorps. Lizak Shalit and Colin Peden produced it for KALW. A new documentary film called No Time to Waste captures Betty's urgent mission. It'll be shown on Monday, September 23rd at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park. Find more info about that at kalw.org. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. Click the Cross Currents tab to find out how.
I've been living in California since 1943. I got those back home blues. That's the kind that worried me.
Today's team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Sarah Lai Sterland, and Jocelyn Tubankai. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adel. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Thank you for listening to KALW. We're listener-supported public radio, and we're here for you. Show your support at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
I'm going back to my bed.